Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. You may have heard me say this before, but every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. This week I've got a must list. I love it when we have a must list. And many articles. Sometimes just a couple articles rule the show, but this time it's a mix of things. I'm going to start with our must list. Netflix's Department Q, and Just Like That, Season 3, and a Felicity Huffman Lifetime movie topped this week's must list. Indie artist Caleb Cohen and a killer Criterion release round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. There's plenty of great TV right now, including the recent finales of Hacks, The Last of Us, and The Studio, but my favorite thing to watch currently is Zoe Saldana squeal in joyous surprise in her new T-Mobile ad. I laugh in delight every time. Who knew I'd ever be glad I haven't sprung for the ad-free version of Paramount Plus? It takes longer to watch Drag Race's Tournament of All-Stars, but it's so worth it. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. And there is a link to Zoe Saldana squealing in joyous surprise in that opening. The first show is Department Q. Cranky detective Carl Mork, played by Matthew Good, back at work after a traumatic shooting, is tasked with heading up a new cold case department. Sounds like standard crime drama stuff, but reader, I was not ready for the chilling twist in the premiere. Adapted from the Danish novels by Scott Frank, known for The Queen's Gambit, the Netflix series is a gripping yarn about the yoke of guilt and the unwavering patience of redemption. Good and co-star Alexej Manilov as Mork's quietly formidable partner, Akram, deserve to leapfrog into the Emmy race with their impeccable performances. And we've got a review of the show in just a moment. Next we have And Just Like That. Carrie, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, Charlotte, played by Kristen Davis, and Miranda, played by Cynthia Nixon, are back for Season 3 of the HBO Max Sex and the City sequel series. While we had to say goodbye to Carrie's iconic apartment and former stars Sarah Ramirez and Karen Pittman, say hello to Rosie O'Donnell's hilarious Mary, Aiden's return, and more. The 13th Wife Escaping Polygamy. People think I'm a monster for what I've done, Felicity Huffman gravely announces in this new Lifetime movie ripped from the headlines surrounding the shocking story of a former Mormon fundamentalist and accused murderer, Raina Chinoweth. Killer of Sheep. Written, directed, shot, edited, and produced by the under-heralded maverick Charles Burnett, this revelatory realist drama, which revolutionized the American indie and kickstarted the influential LA rebellion, finally gets its due with a gorgeous physical release from Criterion. East Coast Summers by Caleb Cohen. Folk rock singer Caleb Cohen has the perfect bonfire song, whether you're on the East Coast, West Coast, or no coast. Shout out to whoever programmed my gym's current playlist with this unconventional pump-up pick, allowing me to catch easy sunny season vibes via this indie earworm. That's our must list this week. Netflix's Department Q, and Just Like That, Season 3, and a Felicity Huffman Lifetime movie topped this week's must list, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So let's take a look at a couple reviews that we just heard about. There is Entertainment Weekly's 2007 DVD release review of Killer of Sheep. So, keeping in mind, this is from 2007, but since it was so amazing, let's take a look at it. A number of things will floor you watching the amazing Killer of Sheep, the Charles Burnett collection. One is that the 1977 title film about the domestic life of a slaughterhouse worker in LA's Watts neighborhood is one of the most quietly moving portraits of Black working class lives ever seen. Another is that the collection's second feature film, 1983's My Brother's Wedding, is, well, one of the most quietly moving portraits of Black working class lives ever seen. In both, male protagonists trapped in contemporary economic hard times find both pressure and comfort from family members. Director-writer Burnett, who also helmed the lovely 1996 slavery-era TV movie Night John, as well as the emotionally complex 1995 cop movie The Glass Shield, used his independently made films to work outside the studio system's commercial genres, developing his own leisurely yet mesmerizing storytelling pace. The collection boasts four of Burnett's short films, including his newest, Quiet as Kept, about a New Orleans family displaced by Hurricane Katrina. There's also an invaluable commentary track by the director on Killer of Sheep, which serves as a primer on how to shoot on a tiny budget while achieving maximal results. Way back in 2007, the writer Ken Tucker gave Killer of Sheep a grade of A-. Coming to something a little more current, here's the Department Q review. Matthew Good is grumpy perfection in chilling crime drama. Matthew Good stars as Carl Mork, a troubled detective tasked with investigating cold cases in Netflix's new drama based on the Danish crime novels. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Cranky Detective Chief Inspector Carl Mork, played by a Discovery of Witches Matthew Good, just back at work after surviving a traumatic shooting, is tasked with heading up a new cold case department. Sounds like standard crime drama stuff, but Department Q defies expectations from its opening scene. Adapted from Jesse Adler Olson's book series by Scott Frank, known for The Queen's Gambit, the series is an instantly gripping yarn about the yoke of guilt and the unwavering patience of redemption. No one is particularly happy to see DCI Mork back on the job at his Edinburgh department. His mood wavers between disgust and disdain, and his people skills are not improved by nearly dying in an ambush that left one policeman dead and Mork's partner, Detective Sergeant Hardy, played by Jamie Sives, in a wheelchair. I had problems with human beings long before I was shot, Mork informs his department-mandated therapist, Dr. Irving, played by Kelly MacDonald, with a smirk. In an effort to keep him out of trouble, Mork's boss, Moira, played by Game of Thrones' Kate Dickey, stashes him in a basement office and charges him with investigating cold cases from all over the country. Rather than staying out of sight, though, Mork starts assembling a team. Hardy, whose paralysis has him grappling with thoughts of suicide. Akram, played by Alexej Manilov, a quietly formidable investigator from Syria. And Rose, played by Lee Byrne, a constable struggling with PTSD of her own. As Mork and his team tackle their first case, we also meet Merritt Lingard, played by Chloe Peary, a dogged prosecutor whose most recent case involved a powerful man, played by Douglas Russell, accused of murdering his wife by throwing her down the stairs. As a professional TV watcher, shows rarely surprise me, but reader, I was not prepared for the chilling twist near the end of Department Q's 65-minute premiere. The result was the best kind of crime drama conundrum for a viewer, when desperation to know more battles it out with dread over what may lie ahead. The season is based on the first book in Adler Olson's series, The Keeper of Lost Causes. It follows Mork as he works on the primary cold case, as well as the ongoing and so far fruitless investigation into his own shooting. Frank, who directs every episode, strikes an effective storytelling balance between highlighting Mork's personal struggles, his guilt over Hardy's paralysis, his clumsy and often obnoxious attempts to discuss his feelings with Dr. Irving, and his tempestuous relationship with Jasper, played by Aaron McVeigh, the sullen teen living under his roof, and the tenacious detective work of his team. Broken people healing themselves by providing closure for crime victims can be an especially effective subgenre if the writing, directing, and casting align, and in Department Q, everything gels beautifully. Good, his posh good looks hidden under a scruffy beard and a messy mop of salt and pepper hair, is mesmerizing as Mork, a right, mean old bastard whose melancholy manifests itself in harsh and often hilarious insults. Manilov is impeccably understated as Akram, and Sives brings an avuncular charm to Hardy, who pulls himself out of his funk by helping Rose work the case. The mystery comes to a satisfying, if a bit convoluted, conclusion, and Frank certainly leaves things open for more grim and grimly funny adventures with his Department Q misfits down the line. "I was a policeman today," Mork informs Jasper with weary pride. "First time in a long time. With any luck, it won't be the last." Department Q is streaming now on Netflix. That was the review. Matthew Good is grumpy perfection in chilling crime drama. It's by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving the series a grade of A-. We have a movie review also. Karate Kid, Legends review. Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio team up for lightweight sequel. Despite charming performances by Ben Wang and Sadie Stanley, the film is far from a knockout. This is by Jordan Hoffman. In the surprise 1984 hit film The Karate Kid, young Daniel LaRusso needs to attend a Halloween dance, but also doesn't want to be seen. He therefore goes as a shower so he can remain behind a curtain. The visual of a shower at a school dance is preposterous and singular. That human touch is all over the simple story of a new kid in town facing down his bullies and why it's remembered today. Karate Kid Legends, the sixth feature in the franchise following six seasons of the Cobra Kai Netflix series, has none of the first movie's originality. The newest entry, while not entirely lacking charm, is toothless corporate hodgepodge. The premise is rote, the story is ludicrous, and the dialogue and characterizations feel as if they were spat out by ChatGPT. It's also lit and shot like a young adult series for Netflix, which makes sense considering that's where the producers plucked director Jonathan Entwistle. It also has some of the most artless product placement to appear in a movie for a minute. Do kids really drink Starry? Gee, this really sounds like a disaster, but weirdly, it's because it is so damned hokey that parts of the movie are agreeable. One can't help but laugh. That, plus the lead performer Ben Wang as Li Fong, is extremely likable. He gives a terrific performance, even if you've seen every beat before. When we first meet Li, he's training at the Kung Fu school in Beijing run by his Uncle Han and an unusually lifeless Jackie Chan. His mother, played by Ming-Na Wen, informs him that she has a new job in New York and they're moving. She also wants him to stop fighting. We quickly ascertain that martial arts are to blame for the death of Li's brother. In New York, Li soon makes friends with Mia, played by Sadie Stanley, a girl who is either his age or years older, it's vague. She works at the local pizza place with her dad Victor, played by Joshua Jackson, who is currently being harassed by loan sharks. The head enforcer's son is also her nasty ex-boyfriend, Connor, played by Aramis Knight, who happens to be a kung fu fanatic and champion of an underground five boroughs tournament. Clearly, Lee and Connor are going to have to compete in this tournament, but the road to get there isn't so straightforward. First, Victor decides that the way out of his financial hole is to enter a different underground fighting competition. He's a former boxer. He enlists Lee to teach him kung fu, so there's a fun musical montage around the pizzeria. They use those giant wooden shovels called peels as swords. It's cute. The night of the fight, which is a boxing match, meaning Victor can't actually use his new kung fu moves, but this never comes up, Lee and Sadie, two fresh-faced kids, are there cheering alongside all the criminals. Things go south, and what this really means is that for his own redemption and the redemption of the pizzeria, and to win back the girl and probably a few other reasons, Lee must fight Connor. Luckily, Uncle Han has flown in from Beijing by now, but his style of kung fu isn't going to be enough. He needs Miyagi-style karate. You know, the famous one from the Karate Kid movies. As it happens, we already know from a brief prologue that either uses AI or someone impersonating the late Pat Morita's voice, that the Okinawan karate from the earlier films was also brought to China by a Miyagi ancestor. The Miyagi and Han styles are two branches of one tree. Thus, Uncle Han zips over to California and drags Daniel LaRusso, played by Ralph Macchio, fresh from the conclusion of Cobra Kai, into the story. Together, Han and Daniel bicker as they train Lee. As with the crane kick from the first film, there's a special move that Lee uses in honor of his brother, and you get to see it in ultra slow motion. Aramis Knight is terrific as the huge jerk, so unless you're completely jaded, you will cheer when he gets kicked in the face. It's also fun that this big fight happens at the top of a skyscraper in Midtown Manhattan. However, while some of the exteriors were actually shot in New York, it remains one of the most unrealistic renderings of the city in recent memory. None of the interiors look real. Pizzeria owners don't actually talk like that. You don't bump into your bully all over the town in a city of 8 million, and the geography is absolutely infuriating. Lee seems to live somewhere in Chinatown, but is told to take the L train to the 6 to get to Canal Street to go to school, which makes zero sense. This isn't the real problem, though. Other than expand the franchise, good luck finding a message in this movie. Mr. Miyagi was a great teacher because he showed when not to fight. Han and Daniel don't really have anything philosophical to say. They don't have much in the way of a wax-on, wax-off gimmick to their methods, either. Poor Ming-Na Wen has ample reason not to want Lee to get involved in a martial arts tournament, but she is roundly ignored right up until the end when she appears to dutifully cheer for her son. It's shoddy writing. Nevertheless, the torch has been passed. No one expected to be talking about The Karate Kid 40 years after the first one, so there's a solid chance we'll see all these characters again. Here's hoping that it's a little less lightweight. That was the Karate Kid Legends review. Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio team up for a lightweight sequel. It was by Jordan Hoffman, who's giving the movie a grade of C+. We have an anniversary of sorts. Here's an article about how Survivor revolutionized television 25 years ago today. TV, for better or worse, has never been the same since May 31st, 2000. This is by Dalton Ross. On May 31st, 2000, a bold and inventive new program would debut on network television, looking to completely upend traditional broadcast norms and change TV as we know it. But Enough about Clerks, the animated series. Seriously, viewers did indeed have enough after a single episode. The ABC cartoon adaptation of the Kevin Smith indie film was canceled a mere week later. However, another new show premiered that same evening, and that show remade the television landscape more than any other program over the past 50 years. At 8 p.m. Eastern Time that night on the Columbia Broadcast System, viewers were treated to something they had never seen before, as average Americans just like them scrambled for supplies on a boat and then plunged into the ocean to begin a previously unfathomable adventure for contestants and viewers alike. That adventure was titled Survivor. Reality competition television is so ingrained into popular culture now that it is almost impossible for anyone under the age of 30 to truly comprehend just how seismic a shift the Survivor premiere was to an American viewing audience in the year 2000. The pre-Survivor Network broadcast schedule for the fall 1990 season was a typical smorgasbord of scripted dramas, The West Wing, and comedies, Just Shoot Me, with a sprinkling of news magazine programs. ABC's recent smash hit game show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and the unfortunate existence of something called Shasta McNasty. That was the setting in which creator Mark Burnett and CBS decided to do something crazy. Stick 16 strangers on an island filled with cameras and not much else, and then watch them build a society from scratch while simultaneously voting each other off the island in a pursuit of $1 million. No scripts. No stars. Even host Jeff Probst was mostly an unknown, his biggest credit being handling Rock and Roll Jeopardy duties on VH1. And pretty much no rules. It was unlike anything and everything that came before it. Audiences were transfixed. Whether it was Richard Hatch perched in a tree just minutes into the game, literally talking down to everyone, truck driver Sue Hawk mincing no words in her reaction, or Rudy Bosch almost instantaneously becoming America's favorite crotchety old grandpa, viewers immediately latched onto the players they loved, loved to hate, or hated to love, and television would never be the same. An astonishing 51.7 million watched Richard the Snake beat Kelly Wigglesworth the Rat in the season finale of Survivor, later retitled Survivor Borneo. In turn, approximately 51 million other reality competition programs were put into production. Some, like The Bachelor, American Idol, The Amazing Race, The Mole, Dancing with the Stars, Temptation Island, and the soon-to-be-rebooted Fear Factor, are still around in some form or fashion today. Big Brother even somehow survived a disastrous first season to become a 25-year standby as well. Many more, Boot Camp, The Family, The Will, Love Cruise, not one but two iterations of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, to name just a few, barely made a ripple and were voted off the broadcast network island. For a while, it seemed pretty much anything could be made into a reality competition series, even if the purpose of those shows remained vague at best. ABC trotted out something called All-American Girl, in which women competed to be the, well, All-American Girl, whatever that was. The network went so deep down the reality competition rabbit hole that they also aired a celebrity impersonator contest called The Next Best Thing. Suffice it to say, it was not. Burnett alone had his own sizable stable of reality follow-ups to Survivor, including, but certainly not limited to, The Apprentice, Rockstar, The Contender, The Restaurant, Boarding House, North Shore, On the Lot, Shark Tank, and The Voice. The point is, reality competition series were suddenly everywhere after Survivor, for better or for worse. The vast majority, if not all, of these entries lacked the originality, the spark, and the incredible production values of the original. A big part of Survivor's legacy as it sets off to Fiji to begin filming its landmark 50th season is not just its own amazing staying power, but the power it demonstrated in completely changing the face of television and the television schedule. In that quaint pre-Survivor landscape, summer TV was a dumping ground for reruns and shows that were being burned off because they were not worthy of being aired during the advertiser-important fall and spring seasons. Hence, Clerks, the animated series. After Survivor, which aired its first season from May 31st through August 23rd, original summer programming became essential, with other longtime reality standouts like American Idol and Dancing with the Stars also beginning their dominant runs in the summer. Summer schedules since have been filled with other shows like Big Brother, Love Island USA, and various iterations of the Bachelor franchise, keeping viewers entertained and or enraged ever since. And new series like NBC's Destination X, which debuted earlier this week, are always on the way. No other program has been as influential in terms of both the types of shows being made and when they were shown. You could certainly make the case that the first Netflix streaming series could, in theory, compete with Survivor for most impactful, game-changing program of the past 50 years. But do you really want to put all your eggs in the Lilyhammer basket? Since Lilyhammer was a Norwegian series merely licensed by Netflix and House of Cards was the first program produced by the streamer, the latter certainly had a big influence on where TV is seen. But the House of Cards production itself, while very good, was nowhere near as wildly different as Survivor and would have been right at home as another gritty anti-hero drama on HBO. In fact, Survivor kicked off an entire genre that is now all over Netflix. The Circle, Love is Blind, Squid Game The Challenge, Outlast, and the aforementioned Temptation Island and The Mole all owe a debt to Survivor as Netflix productions. As does the buzziest streaming reality competition show of all, Peacock's The Traitors, which just happens to star several Survivor alums every season. Survivor's influence continues to be felt directly and indirectly 25 years to the day after it first premiered on May 31st, 2000. And judging by the enthusiasm over next spring's Survivor 50, it doesn't look to fade anytime soon. That was how Survivor revolutionized television 25 years ago, and it was by Dalton Ross. I'm going to take a quick moment between stories here to remind everyone that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. So here's an article about how Jenna Fischer got her role as Pam on The Office after improvising one word. It was so scary, the actress admits, of her daring move. This is by Mika Shana Pierre. It took a daring move to get Jenna Fischer her unforgettable role on The Office. The actress, who played the show's lovable Pam Beasley, shared the backstory on how improv helped her land the role during her audition in an interview with Dana Carvey and David Spade on their Fly on the Wall podcast. I had been auditioning for casting director Allison Jones for about 5 years before The Office, Fisher recalled. When it was time for her to cast The Office, I had a good enough relationship with her that I could say, "Hey, Allison, do you have any advice? I really want this one." And she said, "My advice is don't come in looking hot. Don't come in all done up." Fisher noted that the advice was different from what she usually got, which usually followed the lines of, "You're playing a pediatric nurse, but like hot." but it was the second half of Jones's advice that made the Blades of Glory star apprehensive. And then she said, "We're going to have you improvise during the audition, and my advice is, dare to bore me," Fisher shared. When Fisher auditioned, she was asked to participate in an improvised conversation with showrunner Greg Daniels, asking questions as a documentary filmmaker. "I had that note in my head, and he said, 'Do you like being a receptionist here?' And I just paused, and I said, 'Nothing,'" Fisher told Carvey and Spade. "And then I said, 'No.' And that's all I said." She went on to explain, "I thought it would be funnier to watch me think of all the things I wasn't going to say than to say any of them. She's like a deeply honest person, so she can't lie and say she does like it, but she's also not going to say any more." The daring choice was the move that landed her the role, Fisher said. "Greg told me that's what got me the job." While Fisher admitted that it had been so scary to take such a seemingly aloof response during an audition, she reasoned it's common to want to go for the fences, but having restraint can be the better choice. "For me, the hardest thing about acting is just holding on," she opined. Clearly, she made the right choice as Fisher played the receptionist for the entirety of the show's 9-season run. "It's amazing. It's just an amazing, amazing thing to have been a part of," the actress gushed. "I still can't believe it, and just what it means to people, too. I know that The Office has gotten people through hard times in their lives." We can listen to the full conversation between Fisher, Carvey, and Spade in the podcast that's linked in the article. And that was Jenna Fisher got her role as Pam on The Office after improvising one word. It was by Mikashana Pierre. There are a couple exclusive Entertainment Weekly articles I have from their summer preview. This is from their TV section. Wednesday creators promise horror movie worthy moments in season 2. This is exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. When Netflix series returns, the entire Addams Family is getting in on the action. This is by Samantha Highfill. Creators Mile Miller and Alfred Goff aren't joking around when it comes to Wednesday's highly anticipated second season. "We certainly set out to really stretch ourselves and stretch what the show could do and see where our characters could go," Miller tells Entertainment Weekly. "The last thing you want is people to be disappointed having waited for so long. We really want to ensure that the show is loaded with surprises and comedy and action, and that they see the characters they love, but also introduce new ones." Coming off the show's incredibly successful first season, which hit Netflix in November of 2022, they're looking to expand on the world they've already spent 8 episodes establishing. Fans will remember that season 1 followed a teenage Wednesday Addams, played by Jenna Ortega, as she enrolled in Nevermore Academy and swiftly found herself hunting down a murderous monster. The mystery is a little more complex than season 1, but I also just feel like the world is bigger and you really get to explore other characters, Goff said of the new season. Wednesday's not in every scene, so you get to learn more about Enid, played by Emma Myers. You get to learn more about Bianca, played by Joy Sunday. You also get to learn more about the entire Addams Family as Pugsley, played by Isaac Ordonez, enrolls as a student at Nevermore Academy, and Gomez, played by Luis Guzman, and Morticia, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, also find themselves sticking around for certain reasons. You get to explore the mother-daughter dynamic with Wednesday and Morticia, Goff says, so it's really delving more into the Addams Family and their backstory, but also their relationships. You can have a family that loves each other, but there's still issues and clashes. Speaking of family, The show's adding a third generation of Addams women, as Miller puts it, by bringing in Grandmama, played by Joanna Lumley. She's a whole different flavor of Addams that brings such delicious fun to the show and into the family, Miller says. We weren't sure how many episodes that character should be in, but seeing how well it played, I think Grandmama will definitely be coming back if we get a season three. Outside of new characters, of which there are plenty with this year's cast, including Steve Buscemi, Thandie Newton, Haley Joel Osment, Heather Matarazzo, Billy Piper, and Christopher Lloyd, the show is also looking to make Wednesday proud by taking things even darker in its sophomore season. There's some moments which are definitely horror movie worthy, says Miller. We have that in season one, but I think this season there are moments that are very intense, I'll say. As Miller continues, season two definitely has some moments which are more straightforward horror, and we're very aware that the show is watched by everybody in terms of age groups, so we want to make sure that it's never torture porn, but that there's enough bite to it that it feels that there are real stakes and that people die in this world and it's scary at moments. And I think that's the great tonal shift that the show makes between comedy and horror. Wednesday, season 2 premieres with part 1 on August 6th and part 2 on September 3rd on Netflix. That was an exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. Wednesday creators promise horror movie-worthy moments in season 2. It was by Samantha Highfill. Another exclusive to Entertainment Weekly from their summer preview, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox, First Look. This Is Us writer dramatizes Knox's wrongful conviction. Wrongfully convicted of murder, the polarizing figure now helps tell her own story in a limited series coming to Hulu. This is by Debbie Day. There are some key points here. Amanda Knox was a 20-year-old college student studying abroad before she spent 4 years in an Italian jail for murder. The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox is an 8-episode limited series from This Is Us writer-producer K.J. Steinberg that is coming to Hulu in August. Tell Me Lies star Grace Van Patten took over the role of Knox after Margaret Qualley had to drop out of the series. So those are our key points. People think they know Amanda Knox. They might remember her 2009 conviction in Italy of killing her British roommate and friend, Meredith Kircher. Or maybe they remember the media circus surrounding her and her boyfriend at the time, accused co-conspirator Rafael Solicito, including one sensational take that the killing was some sort of sex torture misadventure, and the Foxy Noxy nickname that came with it. Or they know that her conviction was eventually overturned and Rudy Guid was charged with the sexual assault and murder of 21-year-old Kircher. Or maybe they watched the 2016 Netflix documentary about the whole sordid affair, Amanda Knox, and they think they have the whole picture. This summer, Hulu presents another side of the story with the drama The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox, an 8-episode limited series from creator and executive producer K.J. Steinberg from This Is Us. Knox herself is an executive producer on this telling, inspired by her experiences with the Italian criminal justice system and infamy. But don't call Knox's prosecutors quote-unquote villains. I don't see them as villainous at all, Steinberg tells Entertainment Weekly. I actually see them as good people who woke up every morning thinking they were doing the right thing and taking their jobs extraordinarily seriously. I think we all come to situations with our own biases that we come by honestly. She continues, the show explores the anatomy of bias. Certainly there was misogyny and some could say racism and nationalism and lots of isms. The show is not short on those. But Amanda firmly believes, and I actually firmly believe, that those police and the prosecutor were not bad actors. They came with a set of beliefs, they formed opinions on the scene, and those became some actual biases that folks became entrenched in. And that entrenchment is what is and what was dangerous. Knox's alibi was the film Amelie. Her part-time job had given her the night off, and so she'd spent it with Solicito watching the 2001 French romantic comedy. After a series opener that sees 35-year-old Knox, played by Grace Van Patten, furtively traveling through Italy to meet with her former prosecutor, the series makes use of Amelie's stylized whimsy to introduce a naive, younger Knox, also played by Van Patten, and her dreams of studying abroad. The effect is a study in contradictions, as the jubilant, doe-eyed Seattle native would come to find herself in a version of presumed innocent instead. I was struggling to reconcile myself with this 20-year-old exchange student who grew into this very polarizing figure, Steinberg says. I found that her connection to Amelie really was reflective of a worldview of a person she was before all this happened. The innocence, the romantic idealism, the naivete, the appetite for adventure. All of those things were very representative of who Amanda was and what was stolen from both Amanda and Meredith and their families and the people surrounding them who were re-victimized by the injustice that ensued. So it seemed only appropriate to help the audience get to know her as a person before the false imprisonment, before the false accusations, before the crime, because that's not who she is. That is what her story became, but that's not who she is as a human being. Van Patten, star of Hulu hit series Tell Me Lies, took over the role of Knox after another executive producer on the series, The Substance star, Margaret Qualley, had to drop out because of scheduling conflicts. Steinberg says Van Patten brings so much honesty, so much courage to the role in both timelines. I had trouble remembering that Amanda was a baby when this happened because the press did such a number and because we, as a consumer society, fed on it and bought it, Steinberg says. I had this image of her as this woman. She was called Foxy Noxy. She was this vixen. You don't call a 20-year-old child a vixen. It just doesn't line up, and I think the false narratives around her created this sense of womanhood around her, which was strange and unearned, and people quickly forgot that she was a child. Someone who knows a thing or two about controversy, Monica Lewinsky, is another of the series' executive producers alongside Steinberg, Warren Littlefield, Lisa Harrison, Ann Johnson, Graham Littlefield, and Michael Uppendahl, as well as Knox and her husband Chris Robinson. Steinberg sees a unique connection between Knox and Lewinsky. Monica Lewinsky and Amanda Knox were partnered on this before I was ever approached, and I have such deep respect for both of them, and obviously they have some common trauma, she says. The commonality that they have that I see, they're both extraordinary women, both brilliant, both resilient, and pretty miraculous, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that I could have survived what either of them went through. And they are both very joyful people, despite everything, and very, very committed to changing the corrupt way that we look at, I think, especially young women in the media. And yet, Steinberg still isn't interested in the idea of a villain. If this were a show about good guys and bad guys, I wouldn't be interested in doing it, and I don't think people would be interested in watching it, she says. The show has a wider lens than that. It's looking at What was the ecosystem in which an injustice like this could happen? Who were the players? Where were they coming from? What were their beliefs? And their beliefs were so strong that even when new evidence came in, they couldn't move from their initial conclusions. The series, which also stars Sharon Horgan, John Hugenacker, Francesco Acquaroli, Giuseppe Di Domenico, and Roberta Mattei, premieres August 20th on Hulu with two episodes at launch, then one new episode weekly. That was an exclusive Entertainment Weekly article, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox's First Look. This Is Us writer dramatizes Knox's wrongful conviction, and it was by Debbie Day. Okay, we don't have a lot of time left, so I have a few quick articles. Helen Mirren stuns Actress Roundtable by saying, "None of us are beautiful. We all have really different faces." The star chatted with fellow beauties Kathy Bates, Parker Posey, Niecy Nash-Betts, Kristen Milioti, and Carrie Russell. This is by Jessica Wang. Helen Mirren delightfully stunned her fellow leading ladies by declaring that none of us are beauties in a recent roundtable about their craft. The star, an Emmy contender for her work on Mobland, convened with the lovely Kathy Bates, Parker Posey, Niecy Nash-Betts, Kristen Milioti, and Carrie Russell for the Hollywood Reporter's Drama Actress Roundtable, where they waxed poetic about beauty and some of the worst career advice they've received, including being told to lose weight. "I went home and ate a cookie instead," quipped Nash-Betts. "Or get plastic surgery." Mirren's unexpected remark to her peers came after she revealed that she was told to get a nose job in her 20s. "Someone said, 'You'll never get work if you don't have a nose job,'" Mirren recalled. "I said no. I didn't want to be a pretty actress anyway. I elected to be not so pretty." When Bates remarked that an artist's amazing performance makes them beautiful, Mirren said, "Looking at our faces around this table, none of us are beautiful." Bates quipped in response, "Oh, get out of town. I feel more beautiful than I have in my entire life." But Mirren doubled down. "We're not. None of us are beauties," the Oscar winner said. "We all have really different faces, very interesting faces." Kathy's like, "Speak for yourself," Russell quipped in response. Bates, who has since spoken out about her health struggles, also recounted an agent advising her to keep her ovarian cancer diagnosis private back in 2003 in fear of her becoming the poster child for ovarian cancer. The cancer survivor told the roundtable, "I think if I had come out at that point, maybe it would have helped some people." The Matlock star recently spoke about struggling to book roles because she did not always have typical Hollywood star looks, telling Vanity Fair in an interview published earlier this week that the late Gary Marshall declined to cast her in 1991's Frankie and Johnny because he couldn't envision her as a love interest. The film is an adaptation of the stage play Frankie and Johnny in the Clair de Lune. Bates originated the role of Frankie. "He couldn't make the leap that people would see me on screen kissing someone," Bates said. "Me, actually kissing a man on screen. That would not be romantic." The full roundtable discussion premieres on Sunday. There's a link to it in this article. That was Helen Mirren stuns Actress Roundtable by saying, "None of us are beautiful." It was by Jessica Wang. Eternal nice guy Tom Hanks tells red carpet photographers to shut the F up at movie premiere, and they love it. The actor got in some playful jabs while on the red carpet of his new movie, The Phoenician Scheme. This is by Mikishana Pierre. Few actors can pull off some banter with red carpet photographers like Tom Hanks. On Wednesday, the two-time Oscar winner got in some playful jabs while talking to photographers on the red carpet for the New York City premiere of Wes Anderson's ensemble, The Phoenician Scheme. Hanks, who stars alongside Benicio del Toro, Michael Cera, Bryan Cranston, and Riz Ahmed in the film was all smiles as he posted for photos on the carpet. But as photographers called for the actor to look their way for more snaps, the actor began to poke fun at them for taking too long when he wanted to proceed along the carpet. "Can you hurry it up so I can get to these people? You and your cushy jobs," Hanks quipped in a video shared on MTV's social media. "I want to be right where the other photographers are." The 68-year-old even gestured for the photographers to hurry it up so he could keep moving. "Shut the F up," he jokingly yelled when the photographers cried out in protest as he started to move away. The assembled photographers broke out into laughter as the star smiled and continued posing for the photos. Hanks also posed for group photos alongside his cast members and director Anderson. Phoenician Scheme stars Del Toro as fictional industrialist Zsa Korda, who embarks on a new enterprise with his daughter Liesl, played by Mia Threapleton, and tutor Bjorn, played by Sarah. Hanks and Cranston play basketball-loving sibling duo Leland and Reagan, respectively. Cranston, who was similarly in good spirits according to People, told the outlet that some of his favorite movies from shooting the film was Playing Brothers with Hanks. "I think it was when Tom and I, playing brothers, were absolutely marveling at what Benicio del Toro was asked to do. Massive amounts of very tricky dialogue," he shared. "Tom and I are going, 'My God, I'm so glad I don't have that role.' We were saying to Del Toro, 'What can we do for you? What can we bring you? Can I massage your feet?'" The Phoenician Scheme is in theaters now. That's Eternal Nice Guy Tom Hanks tells red carpet photographers to shut the F up at movie premiere, and they love it. It was by Mikishana Pierre. And last, we've got Alan Alda saying his face blindness made him not recognize his daughter. I don't think she was too happy about it. This is by Lauren Huff. "Good one, Dad." Emmy and Golden Globe-winning actor Alan Alda is opening up about the time he didn't recognize his own daughter due to a condition he'd later come to find out was prosopagnosia, or face blindness. In all fairness, the incident occurred on the set of Alda's film, The Four Seasons, after he had had his daughter Beatrice dye her hair a completely different color for her role in the comedy. "I saw this person with horn-rimmed glasses and blonde hair staring at me, and it was starting to get distracting," Alda recalled to People. "I said to the assistant director, 'Don't let these strangers come on the set.' He said, 'That's your daughter.' I don't think she was too happy about that, because neither of us knew that there was such a thing as face blindness at the time." Alda said to this day it's very hard for him to recognize people due to the condition. "When somebody comes up to me as if they know me, I often don't know if they know me from seeing me on the screen or if I actually know them," he told the outlet. "I could have dinner with somebody, spend 2 hours with somebody next to me, and the next day, not know who they are." Alda, 89, has been open about his health struggles in recent years. In 2018, he revealed he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2015. At the time, he told CBS This Morning, he decided to reveal his diagnosis after noticing his thumb twitch during some recent TV appearances to promote his podcast, Clear and Vivid with Alan Alda. "I thought it's probably only a matter of time before somebody does a story about this from a sad point of view, but that's not where I am," he said. Speaking with People more recently, Alda gave an update on his condition, telling the outlet, "I don't have dexterity with my fingers the way I used to, so sometimes my wife Arlene has to tear a package open for me," he said. "She's so good-natured about it. I'm always saying thank you." He also admitted that while managing his Parkinson's has gone from a part-time job to almost a full-time job over the past 10 years, he's still able to keep a positive outlook. "It keeps me always looking for the funny side," he said. That was Alan Alda says his face blindness made him not recognize his daughter. I don't think she was too happy. And it was by Lauren Huff. That was a fun way to wrap up the show. I'll also mention that if you don't know about this, you can download an app for Sun Sounds. Yes, there's an app for that. You can download it from the Apple Store or Google Play. Once you've downloaded it to your device, and it can be your phone or your tablet, whatever, you can listen to live feeds, or you can listen on demand to recently recorded episodes like the one you're listening to right now. So, okay, I snuck in a little bit about the app, too. But that wraps up our time for this week and Entertainment Weekly. I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I am volunteer reader Diane Salisbury. Thank you for listening this week. Please come back next week, and we'll cover more in entertainment. Until then, goodbye.